Good afternoon. I'm assuming that you're here because you've read the flyer, so I'm not going to cover that ground. We're going to talk about the pros and cons of the FISA court. Has it achieved a good balance between individual rights and national security? We're going to go into the origins of the court, its original purpose, how its charter has been changed to reflect the additional issues that it now faces. We're going to get into things like Edward Snowden and the government's collection of metadata, criticisms of the FISA court, and much, much more. Our speakers today are two fellows, senior fellows at the Law School Center for National Security Law, Ashley Deeks, right here, and Fred Hitz. Ashley is also an associate professor at the law school, and prior to joining the law school's faculty, she was the assistant legal advisor for political military affairs in the legal advisor's office at the State Department, where among many other duties, she advised on intelligence issues. She has also served as a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She's a cum laude graduate of Williams College and an honors graduate of Harvard Law School. Fred Hitz is an adjunct professor at the law school and also at the Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy. For many years, while being a lawyer, he was also an operative of the CIA, both in line and staff positions. He's written extensively on espionage and intelligence issues. Please welcome Ashley Deeks and Fred Hitz, and Ashley will speak first.
Terry, thank you very much for that introduction. Terry mentioned that many of you are not that familiar with the FISA court. I should assure you that you are in good company. I mentioned to a colleague of mine that I was coming to speak to you today, and she said, oh, what about? And I said, the FISA court. And she said, what's that? So you at least are already ahead of one of my esteemed law school colleagues on knowing that there is a FISA court. So when Terry asked us to speak, he phrased it as an interest in teeing up the debates about the FISA court. And I think Fred and I do want to accomplish that goal. But I think in order to have a coherent debate about what the FISA court has done right and what it has done wrong, it's useful to understand, first and foremost, why Congress created the FISA court, to understand a bit about how the court is structured, but in the statute, and some of the shifts in the wake of 9/11 that we have asked the court to undertake. And when I say we, I mean primarily Congress. I think with those details in mind, it is then easier to understand some of the problems that have arguably arisen and some of the critiques that we may have heard about the court. Understand why it was that Congress saw fit to amend the original FISA statute to update it in response to some of the felt needs of the executive branch. And then we can make an overall assessment of its work. So with that, I'm going to take us back a little bit to the beginning of FISA and actually start with sort of a footnote to understand the difference in the scenarios we're talking about today, which are largely foreign intelligence collection, and the more traditional context of criminal warrants. So what are called Title III warrants, or warrants obtained to conduct a search in pursuant of a criminal prosecution. There, an executive agent appears before a judge, does so ex parte, doesn't have the person whose home is to be searched with him or her, and has to show probable cause that the person has committed or is about to commit a criminal offense, and then have the judge issue a warrant for the person to then go search, for example, the house of that person. And at that point, when you show up at somebody's house with your warrant, you have to give the person the warrant and say, look, here's the warrant. I'm going to come in and search. And you're supposed to do it, for example, generally not at night, And remember, this also happens frequently after a crime has been committed. So that's one world of warrants and searches, and we're in a slightly different world when we're thinking about the FISA court. In the 1970s, it actually wasn't clear whether the government had to get a warrant before it was conducting national security surveillance, which looked to some people like a search under the Fourth Amendment. The difference was that the information was being collected for a different purpose. It was not in pursuit of necessarily a criminal prosecution, but it was an attempt, for example, to detect spies who were in the United States who were engaging in espionage against us. So the executive was engaged in national security surveillance without a warrant. And an important case came before the Supreme Court. It was a case called Keith. And what had happened is there was a CIA bombing on the University of Michigan's campus, and the executive branch thought that they knew what group was behind the bombing, and they engaged in wiretapping of those individuals without a warrant. Why? Because they were worried about a national security threat posed by this group. And there, in that case, the court said, well, not so fast, actually, executive. You actually do have to obtain a warrant when you're engaged in this kind of surveillance against a purely domestic national security threat. These were individuals who were, the suspected group were American citizens. Their activities were all taking place domestically. And the court said, you have no connection to what we might call foreign powers, that is, foreign governments. And so, yes, executive, you do actually have to obtain a warrant before you wiretap this group. The executive had objected to that idea, and says so in the case as it's arguing to the court. It says, look, obtaining prior judicial review and get it before we get up on a wiretap would actually obstruct the president's ability to protect the United States. They're basically making a kind of timing and an urgency argument there. They also say, look, courts lack the capacity to make the kind of probable cause determination that they're used to making in the criminal context, because here we're asking whether surveillance would be necessary to protect the national security of the United States. And that's not something, the executive said, that courts are really particularly equipped to do. Finally, the court said, we're also worried about disclosure. And particularly, we're worried about disclosing the information we have on these groups to the courts, partly because we're worried it might leak, right? It's not just the judges who would see the information. It's their staff, their clerks, their secretaries. So they were worried that going to a court in advance would increase the danger of leaks and therefore tip off potentially the targets. So again, the court in Keith says, no, where you're talking about purely domestic national security threats, the executive has to obtain a warrant. But the Keith court is notably silent, intentionally silent, about whether that applies to activities that involve foreign powers, foreign national security threats. The court doesn't say anything about those. So the question comes up in a number of cases in the lower courts, in the district courts, and so on, and the courts start coming out in different places on that question about whether the executive needs a warrant when it is trying to surveil for foreign intelligence purposes. And you might ask, well, why would we be concerned as a security matter about domestic national security threats versus foreign security threats? Do we actually think that foreign security threats are more potent, such that we want to give the executive more leeway to tap those? And maybe the answer there, at least at the time, seemed to be yes. Okay, well, why? Well, one reason might be that you think that if there is a foreign power behind a particular threat to the United States, and again, foreign power, let's think Russia, maybe that's going to be a more serious threat, a more potent threat than a bunch of guys, you know, three guys bombing a CIA office in the University of Michigan. Plus, you might think, the U.S. has a greater set of law enforcement tools to manage domestic security threats than it does to manage overseas threats, where we can't just go abroad and arrest people, right? There are foreign sovereign equities in doing that. So that was one contemporary problem going on in the courts and with regard to warrant questions at the time. There were two other contemporaneous problems that ultimately also, I think, stimulate Congress to enact the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. One of the problems had to do with abuses by intelligence agencies. So the U.S. government in the early 70s, in the late 60s, early 70s, was routinely reading vast amounts of U.S. mail. The FBI and others would start out collecting information about foreign threats, but very quickly slip into collecting things that looked more like related to domestic threats. So they'd start gathering intel on peaceful domestic groups who were protesting, for example, the Vietnam War. The CIA was at that point flagrantly disregarding what were already existing statutes like the 1947 National Security Act. It was not complying with the statutory regime set up there. The NSA read virtually all incoming cables for about 30 years that were coming in from overseas. And the FBI under Nixon was providing the White House with political or personal information that President Nixon was interested in that had nothing to do with national security. So there was a widespread set of abuses. This was recognized in the Church Committee report that was tasked with investigating what was going on with our intelligence community. So that was the second problem. The third problem is just frankly the lack of an existing legal regime to regulate this kind of activity. There was very limited regulation and oversight at this point in time. There were not formalized, even executive directives, let alone statutory directives. The executive hadn't issued very many things to structure its intelligence activities. The FBI was functionally operated outside of the realm of the Department of Justice. And was favored by the White House, so the White House would go right to the FBI rather than through the Attorney General, which was the appropriate route. And Congress was highly deferential to the executive on these issues. So the Church Committee levies these significant criticisms. One way to deal with all three of these types of problems is to have Congress step in and regulate. So that's what the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, arises from. And some people have described what emerges as a grand bargain. So what does that mean? Well, it reflects this paradoxical need to submit what had been secret programs to some kind of democratic oversight. So there would be legal constraints on these kinds of spying, but the oversight would be conducted in secret, right? And that's there's a little bit of tension in there. So what was the deal? What was the grand bargain? Well, the executive, who had been content, indeed happy, to engage in this kind of surveillance without this kind of oversight, agrees to have it be brought under a statutory umbrella and made, frankly, subject to accountability. Congress says, okay, well, we'll provide oversight, but behind closed doors. So we will, in our intelligence committees, review what you're doing, but it's not going to be public for all to see. We'll also make clear through this statute that foreign intelligence collection is, in fact, lawful, that this isn't something to be ashamed of. It's just something we need to structure and do more systematically. And the courts agree to buy into this FISA arrangement and to also provide oversight over these activities, but again behind a curtain. So it uses what we think of as a sort of familiar separation of powers among the three branches, with each branch having a different task, and common oversight tools, that is Congress and Article III courts. Those are the common tools for lots and lots of things the executive does. But it creates a small subset of those bodies to do this oversight in secret. So it's trying to balance the executive's need to legitimately conduct foreign intelligence surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes with the fundamental principles of the Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment, so that they can protect, in particular, U.S. citizens against improper searches. Okay, so that's why we have the FISA Act and the FISA Court. What does the court look like? How is it structured? Well, there are three layers of activity. The first is the FISA court itself. There is also a FISA court of review that can, it will review petitions that are, let's say the FISA court at the first level rejects a government's application, the government appeals, it will go to the FISA court of review. And then, again, if the executive loses again, it can be appealed to the Supreme Court. The FISA court, who's on it? Well, it's 11 U.S. district court judges. That means that they are all Article III judges who have gone through the regular advice and consent process and been confirmed by the Senate. So these are your average district court judges drawn from seven U.S. circuits, right? The country's divided into a number of different circuits, so they are geographically diverse in their selection. The Chief Justice appoints them. He says, okay, well, let's look at who my district court judges are. I'm going to select judges for the court. And they sit for 7 years doing FISA duty. But they also have their day jobs. It's not a permanent. They rotate through into Washington, but they still have a significant part of their normal caseload. Okay. The FISA Court of Review is three district court or court of appeals judges, again, selected by the Chief Justice. And they will review any denial of an appeal. If they deny it, it has to be in writing, so that it gives the Supreme Court something to actually review. And the courts, who are then therefore reviewing lots of highly classified information, have worked with the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence to establish appropriate security procedures for reviewing these sensitive cases. Okay. Just very briefly, six basics of FISA, just so we know more or less what we're talking about. It's a very complicated statute, and the definitions are highly, highly technical. But we're generally talking about electronic surveillance, again, where the primary purpose is not a criminal investigation, but what you're trying to do is collect foreign intelligence information. So you're trying to detect espionage. Terrorism is also covered, so you're trying to detect terrorist acts before they happen. So this would include taps on cell phones, landlines, accessing stored emails. The U.S. government can only target one group of people, and that is either foreign powers or agents of foreign powers. So either the Russian government or a diplomat working for Russia, for example. Or an American citizen who's secretly working for Russia. That person would also presumably count as an agent of a foreign power. It actually sets higher standards to obtain a FISA warrant for an American citizen who's believed to be an agent of a foreign power than if the person were a foreign national. So Congress was particularly attuned to giving American citizens increased protection against being subject to a FISA order. So FISA has to, it articulates a probable cause standard that has to be met before the electronic surveillance can be authorized. But it's a different probable cause standard from the kind I described in the Title III criminal context. So it basically relates to probable cause about the identity of the target, that the person is an agent of a foreign power, say, and a reasonable belief that the facility you're trying to surveil, maybe it's a phone booth, maybe it's a cell phone, is going to be used by the agent of the foreign power. And then FISA, as I mentioned, establishes the FISC, to review the U.S. government's applications for this electronic surveillance. And the only circumstances in which the government can conduct the surveillance are after the court has approved the application, or there's a little provision in case of emergency, in which case it has to get approval within 7 days after it has initiated the surveillance. And finally, we're talking about electronic surveillance that's almost entirely conducted in the United States or against U.S. citizens. So we are not talking about surveillance that happens, let's say, hypothetically, from within a U.S. embassy in a foreign country against that foreign ministry, for example. That would not be covered by FISA. That's under a different and less onerous regime. Okay, so that was the original FISA, and that was how things operated for a while. You have the FISA court reviewing individualized applications that detail specific persons to be targeted, right? But after 9/11, Congress authorizes two what are called programmatic statutes that sweep more broadly. So these are programs that persist over time. They implicate a wider range of communications, and they're not specifically targeted at one or two people. They are they sweep in more communications and therefore end up being quite a bit more controversial. The first is, you may have heard of Section 215 of the Patriot Act. This was a statute that authorized the U.S. government to apply to the FISC for a court order to obtain any tangible things from companies for an authorized investigation to protect against international terrorism. So think, for example, motel registers or credit card receipts, getting credit card receipts from a store where you think that an individual has been shopping. And the U.S. application has to include a statement of facts to the court that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the tangible items sought are related to an authorized investigation, related to an investigation. So, okay, well, that sounds not crazy. So what happens here? Well, the FISC accepts a U.S. government interpretation of this statute that is quite different from what many people think the plain meaning of the statute would suggest. The FISC accepts the idea that the U.S. government can obtain the metadata, meaning the who called who, not the content of the communication, but the who called who, where, for all calls, all telephone calls, where one or both ends were in the United States. So why? Well, the U.S. government, in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, decided that it needed all of the metadata that was out there in order to search after the fact for connections between terrorist actors. And if you don't have all the data, then after the fact, there's nothing to go back to and try to figure out, well, who did that person know, who was that person calling, and so on. So the idea here is that the U.S. government was allowed to collect all of this metadata without probable cause, but it was only allowed to peek inside that data where it had reasonable suspicion that the information was going to be important in pursuing a particular terrorism investigation. So it actually did narrow the inquiry, but only after it had brought all of this data under its potential control. So that was one change that we see with regard to what the FISA court's being asked to do. A second change is what's referred to as Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. So this relates to a technological change that happened. So as the internet became bigger and bigger, right, in 1978 there wasn't an internet. Here we are in 2016, the internet's massive. And the U.S. becomes a key transit point for international wire communications. That includes email communications. Why? Because many ISPs are based in the U.S. So you could have somebody in France emailing his friend in Germany, and it passes through the United States by virtue of our dominance in this area. So what did that mean? Well, it meant that collecting on that communication, which earlier would not have triggered FISA, remember I said the embassy to foreign ministry, not covered by FISA, now would be covered by FISA if you're trying to collect the information from the ISP, because the ISP is in the United States. So all of a sudden, the government says, wait a minute, this is way too much work. This is not what the FISA enactors meant to accomplish here. We're having to get individualized warrants to collect electronic surveillance of purely foreign emails that just happen to pass through the United States. So Congress makes a change to FISA here, too, and it says, look, we're authorizing the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence to identify categories of foreign intelligence information that it wants to collect. So this might be, we're not quite sure what these categories are, but we've been told they're at least information concerning terrorism or information concerning weapons of mass destruction directed at non-American targets who are not in the U.S. So again, there's this interest in making sure this is targeted not at American citizens. And so the court then will bless these categories, and they also bless what are called minimization techniques, which are ways in which the intelligence community makes sure it doesn't send around a lot of American citizen information. And then the executive picks specific email addresses that are called selectors or phone numbers and sends them to the ISP or the telephony companies to get data from the ISPs that way. Okay, so why are you guys here? Well, one reason you might be here is because you've heard of or are intimately familiar with the controversies surrounding this type of surveillance practice generally. But I think it's useful to break down what precisely the controversies are, because I think what you may agree with me on is that not all of them, and in fact maybe not a majority of them, are actually about the FISA court. They're about other things. There are some disputes about the FISA court, to be sure. But one of them has to do with executive abuses of the data that it obtained. Now, the NSA and the U.S. government has said vehemently there are very few instances in which our analysts misused the information they'd gathered or acted in a way that was not permissible under the minimization techniques or the statutes. But there's a fight about how that, you know, how big is big in terms of abuses and so on. Second potential controversy was the mere fact of this broad collection, right? The mere fact that the U.S. government was collecting all of the telephony metadata. Another controversy has been, okay, well, how effective have these programs been? If we're going to let the government do this, we want to know that we've gotten a pretty good bang for our buck. And there's a dispute about whether these programs have actually deterred or stopped various terrorist activities or not. Then there is a dispute about the FISA court. Has the FISA court basically been a pushover or a rubber stamp of what the executive has asked for? And I think we'll talk a bit about that here. Some people argued that the 215 program, the metadata program, was inconsistent with the statutory language because it was sweeping well beyond what a relevant investigation was. Some people said that it was actually unconstitutional. It violated the Fourth Amendment. And in fact, one federal court did later find that that it was unconstitutional, and another found it was constitutional. So there was outside of the FISA court, there were splits among the Article III judges about the constitutionality of the program. Some people worry about the infrequency with which the FISC is thought to reject applications from the executive. I think that is reflects a slight misunderstanding of how the process works. So I have a friend of mine who's an attorney at the FBI General Counsel's office come and talk to my class about this. And she talks about the process by which the FBI assembles the package that it presents to the FISC to obtain a warrant. And it is excruciatingly long. It's excruciatingly painful. There are many, many people involved, agents, many lawyers, all the way up the chain in the FBI, all the way up the chain in the defense, in the Justice Department. And then there's a back and forth with the court. So you present your package to the court, and the court often says, "This isn't enough. So we're not going to deny the warrant. We're just going to give the package back to you and say, you need some more stuff, or you need to defend more clearly this allegation in the package," or so on. So you never get you don't get an approval, but you don't get a rejection either. You then go fix your package. Then when you feel as though you've accomplished it, you bring it back to the court, and the court will approve it. So the 95% approval rating reflects that process. It's not just you asked for it, you got it. Okay, I'm almost out of my time. I just wanted to mention in passing the USA Freedom Act. So in the wake of the Snowden leaks, which is actually the basis for which we have come to know a lot of what we know now, Congress decides to respond, in particular to the Section 215 controversy, by eliminating bulk metadata collection. So now the companies hold it, and the executive asks specific queries of it as authorized by the court. And Congress also makes some structural changes to FISA. One is, and these relate to the court, one is they authorize amici, that is, people who are friends of the court that FISC can consult with These are people particularly with either technical or civil liberties backgrounds. So if the court is facing a complicated statutory interpretation, it's not just going on what the government briefs argue, it's also has outside people who can advise it. And there have actually been those five amici have been identified and appointed to in the event that the court wants to use them. Finally, there's an increase in transparency required in the USA Freedom Act that emphasizes the declassification of opinions and allows those who have been subject to FISA orders or national security letters to report the basic number of requests that they've received. So that is Twitter or Yahoo or Google could report, we received 5,000 requests in the following, 3 months or so. Okay, so I think with that, I will turn it over to Fred to fill in everything I've missed, which is a lot, and then we can talk more.
On the contrary, Ashley, you covered the waterfront beautifully. And what I'd like to do, because I don't want to intrude too much on the audience's ability to ask hard questions, is just underscore some of the important points that were made here. For one thing, you're dealing with a situation where you're trying to identify spies, at least in part, as Ashley said. And overseas, working with governments where CIA stations or FBI legal attaché offices are located, the cooperation with the host government varies, obviously, from place to place, but we get tremendous cooperation in some places where the people whom we want to identify or try to determine whether or not they are spies are located, goes forward without the very meticulous set of requirements set forth in the FISA situation, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court situation in the United States. So we have several realities here. The parties in interest ought to be underscored. I spent a fair amount of time in CIA. We dealt a lot with the National Security Agency that was in the business of collecting voice messages from everywhere. They were absolutely scrupulous in not revealing the names of a U.S. person, an American citizen, unless there was a court order to do so, or unless there was a reason that would make or break, if you will, the authenticity of the report. So it's a mistake to think, as has often been reported in background coverage of it, that the United States is hanging out there, the National Security Agency in particular, with these enormous vacuum cleaners in space, collecting all these messages, just waiting to unwind them. That's not the case at all. They're very careful about the notion of a U.S. person and his or her rights. What's changed is the extent to which electronic media, the social media so-called, is used for communications. I just finished talking to my colleagues at the Batten School earlier this week about the incredible difficulty we're having in gaining information about what the genuine threats are to the United States, and we look at what's happening to our colleagues and allies in Europe, and they have the same difficulty without the same constitutional protections. So often in the past, what would happen would be that an individual would seek, a foreigner would seek admission to the United States, and we would have grave doubts about that person's background, just based on the material that we got from our station overseas or from the embassy generally. And we would want to determine whether or not this person was the agent of a foreign power, the sort of official definition of a spy. And as Ashley says, to cope with that, the procedure was set up after a famous opinion by Mr. Justice Powell in the 80s or the 90s?
Keith case?
I'm sorry, it doesn't matter. It's got a little age on it. Yeah. And so that the notion of just freewheeling and gathering this information based on a record of the individual's activity, who they hung out with, that kind of thing was really not possible when you were talking about an American citizen. Fast forward to situations primarily during the period of the Clinton administration, because they were not really interested in doing a lot of this spade work overseas. We had information about individuals that we couldn't make use of in the United States because of our inability. The Attorney General of the United States took a very strong view of what grand juries should be for and what should be brought before a magistrate in terms of seeking permission for a wiretap. And the cooperation between the criminal division of the Department of Justice and the FBI working on these cases domestically was severely reduced. So we were missing out on a lot we thought we were missing out on a lot of information, not only relating to the U.S., but relating to the activities of U.S. persons who were involved in some fashion, not only in the United States, but overseas in acting against American interests. Now, we're going to jump, we know, in the question period about into the issue raised by Mr. Snowden. But almost as broad as the Snowden issue is the notion of the problem that the 9/11 attack created for law enforcement. There had to be a group out there, said we, government generally, who saw the effectiveness of the hijacking and is going to look for ways to do damage to the United States again. We have to be ready to take whatever lead we get in this regard and find out what we can find out. And as Ashley said, by the virtue of modern technology, a lot of messages pass through U.S. space that are destined to run from Party A, who's located in the Philippines, let's say, all the way back to Spain, or something of that kind. Just by force of technology, they come through the United States airspace, and we can gather that information. The question is, can we look at it? And the answer is that with respect to Americans, as Ashley has pointed out, you've got to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and you have to have a pretty good case. But we have a body of opinion in the United States that says we just can't use our vacuum cleaners that way. And pressure has been put on the National Security Agency to cut back on the metadata that it's creating. I have a personal aside on this. I have a daughter, son-in-law, and two wonderful grandchildren who live in Alta, just outside of Salt Lake City, and they can almost see the building that the United States government is putting up near Provo, where all of this metadata, that is, the to and the fro, the date, the place, are known to us, but the conversation not. And the point I'm making it is we are collecting an enormous amount of information running from a call originating outside the United States to an individual in the United States. We'd love to know who that individual is, but we're not going to be able to find that out unless we've got some additional information that would tie them to a terrorist attack or the potential therefore. So there's no lack of material coming in that may or may not have significance for plots being raised against the United States. How we open it up, however, remains quite difficult in the way that Ashley set forth for us. I might as well get it out because you're going to want to know. What do I think about Snowden? I think if he really had believed sincerely believed in the merits of what he was doing, he would maybe have done part of it. I don't want to excuse him for the whole load. But what I would have done would have been, well, it's easy for me to say. I would have thrown myself on the mercy of the court and have this matter all thrashed out for the world to see. Why did you do it? Why did you have this suspicion as a member of NSA and one who had been in a contractor position rather than a line office position during this period of time? And we could have a debate about it, just what I was talking about. Isn't the United States entitled, because it has the technical competence, to do everything in its power to make sure we're not the subject of another attack? I think we would say that, short of depriving an individual or individuals of liberty on no basis. We'd like to know if that outside force is communicating with somebody in the United States and trying to encourage them to take action against the U.S. government. So I feel that Snowden, if he feels strongly that this is an action that is reprehensible and shouldn't happen in the United States, he ought to be willing to duke that out in court so we could have an illustration of exactly how dangerous it is, how really unacceptable it is. Instead, we've had sort of a up and down balance of what has been appropriated for NSA to do its job. NSA, you know it, no such agency. It used to be the Army Security Office and the Naval Security Office. It's the Navy that collected the information about the Japanese Navy and what was going on, unfortunately not in time to prevent Pearl Harbor, but at least in time to capture and kill one of the highest-ranking admirals in the Japanese Navy. Same thing for the Army in matters that related to Europe. And so I think, just to move you forward, you have to have some kind of faith, trust but verify, in the goodwill and the patriotism of the NSA situation. I was the Inspector General of CIA. I helped Porter Goss, when he was chairman of the House Committee, to deal with the problem of Edward Snowden before it became a problem. That is, the disgruntled employee who doesn't like what he's discovered about his agency spying. He's got an objection to it. Instead of going to the public and getting out this long brief, which he did with the help of a senior editor of one of the, I guess, the Manchester Guardian and another very capable American journalist, instead of going to the, you know, to the finish line before his grievance, his concerns were dealt with, we passed a law that made it possible for the inspectors general to serve as a halfway house. An employee like Snowden could have said, I do not like what's going on here. I do not think we have any real controls over whose information we are looking at and bandying about. I think it's illegal. I think you should take it to the president. If you don't do that, I'd like you to let me take it to the Congress. That's a role that maybe an inspector general can play and maybe he can't. But as Ashley said, this is a problem. We want to do right with respect to not having any more spying on American individuals than we have to, but we also want to protect the country. And those of you, I make all my classes read that first 50 pages of the 9/11 Commission report. They got to read the whole report too, but I'm really grinding them down on the first 50 pages, all of which passed through Philip Zelikow's PC. Many of you must know of him. He's a professor in the history department at UVA and was on Capitol Hill, and he conducted that investigation. But you can't read the details there without, you know, the shimmies going up your back. We got some planes, says Mohammed Atta. This golden day in the fall. I got a vignette on that, too. But this was, we were completely unaware, caught completely unaware by this kind of attack. And we have to make sure, as best we can, that it doesn't happen again. The vignette I have is, summertime resident of Maine forever. And as I say, everything broke for the attackers on that September day. Mohammed Atta, who was the leader and the first plane out, made the determination that he didn't think he wanted to go through the TSA at Logan Airport. They had a reputation for being fairly thorough. So he said, I got the idea. I'm going to go up and get on, start this flight in Portland, where there was a shuttle. Portland to Boston, you go into Logan, you go through a side door, and you're on your next plane. No Boston security. But what could they have had? They could have had a nor'easter. They could have had an autumn storm. They bought those tickets. They had that flight set up months in advance. He could have been a couple of hours late making the connection if he made it at all. And it just shows you that, as I say, everything broke for them on that horrible day and not for us. So, Ashley, let's stand up here and take the questions. What do you think? Oh, we got that, don't we? Okay.
Thank you. As you all know, I hope, this is podcast, so before asking your question, raise your hand. One of these gentlemen will come by with a wireless mic, speak into the mic. Questions. Bob McGrath.
Thank you. But so you don't like the way Snowden did it, Fred. But would you agree that considering, for example, I think it was Clapper's testimony to Congress, that actually they certainly weren't doing metadata, as I recall, collection and so forth, would you agree that the machinations in Congress in 2015, I think there's this U.S. Freedom Act now and so forth, that at least there's some disclosure of what the FISA court is doing and so forth? Do you think that's a good thing, and that Snowden's bashing around at least accomplished a kind of a good corrective there?
I think it's terribly important for the American people to be free to ask these questions. Tell me, explain to me what's going on. How does this procedure work? I thought what Ashley talked about, for example, in the fact that on the first never had a problem being heard before in my life. On the first brush through the FISC, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, oftentimes the judges say, yep, you've got some interesting points here, but you didn't get it all the way. You've got to, there are a lot of questions we have that have to be answered, because none of this is subject to perfect knowledge. And so I think it has been useful to know the extent to which NSA is reaching out to get these questions, get these contacts that are coming from suspected terrorists abroad to we do not know who Americans in our country. But that's a hell of a way to do it. I think it's got to be done systematically and not just throw it into the hopper the way he did.
One additional thought on that, which is, so your question presumes a little bit that that Congress was not fully apprised of what was going on. And while it may be the case that there were some members of Congress who weren't, I do think it's also pretty clear that a not insignificant number of members of Congress on the intelligence committees knew what was going on. There was a time at which Ron Wyden, who was opposed to these programs, didn't reveal their contents on the floor of the Senate, but did say, boy, if only you knew how the government was interpreting Section 215, it would knock your socks off. So that suggests that there were people inside Congress who knew about it, and some subset of them were unhappy with how it had been interpreted. So the way this all works correctly is if all three branches are doing their jobs. And so, right, you need the court to be doing its job, robustly challenging questionable interpretations by the executive. You want the executive to be relatively forward-leaning in trying to get in foreign intelligence information that we think will protect us, and you want Congress to be providing real oversight. And so I think we need to make, you know, we need to ask whether everybody in that three-legged stool was doing its job.
I've heard the FISA court referred to as America's very own star chamber. Could you please put that in historical context, and whether you agree or not, and in view of your historical review of it, it seems to me that this might be true for the original FISA court, but not now with the amendments that have been made? Or can you just clarify all that?
Why don't I say what star chamber is for everyone, and you can say what went on. Star chamber is a reference to the it's not medieval, but it's, pardon me?
Elizabethan.
Oh, I know it's, Elizabethan time. So, 15th century tribunal that existed in Britain where matters of state were considered without any publicity, without any record, without any check on the individual who heard the matter. Now you get the tough part.
Well, so my understanding of Star Chamber also was that it was in a criminal forum. And so what could come out of a Star Chamber is a declaration that someone was guilty and should be summarily executed, say. So, of course, FISA is not about criminal process or putting people behind bars. And importantly, I didn't mention this, but when information comes out of a FISA warrant, that the government then decides that it wants to use in a criminal case, it has to reveal that information to the individual who, the individual defendant in the case.
Pursuant to the usual rules.
Pursuant to the usual rules, right. The second part of your question suggested, well, maybe it's gotten better now that there have been amendments. I guess I would say the original FISA, the 1978 FISA, that was individual applications about individual targets of surveillance, was actually maybe less controversial than the changes that we saw in the wake of 9/11, where we started to see this more programmatic surveillance. And then the USA Freedom Act, which is the third iteration now of the the FISA amendment via the that made the changes I referred to about adding amici, making the opinions more transparent, and so on, is an attempt to sort of further lift the curtain from some of the secrecy that we saw to date. But the court does need to operate in secret. It's very hard to imagine what an alternative is to a FISA court. One alternative is the executive just does it on its own, right? That was the pre-FISA world, and that wasn't very appealing. Those were all the abuses that I discussed earlier. Or you treat it all like a criminal process, and then you're showing the warrants to the individuals you're trying to tap, then immediately defeating the purpose of detecting plots and spying that you're trying to avoid. So you may have discomfort about some of the aspects of FISA and the breadth of some of the reach, but it is hard to imagine quite how you do this another way.
I'd like to go back to Snowden for just a second. I have friends, close friends, who both, husband and wife, too, who both worked at FSTC, which was Army intelligence, and she, who is a very gentle, kind person, says that Mr. Snowden should be drawn and quartered as a traitor because of
Star Chamber.
She's because of the perilous position that it put our spies abroad in, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and it affected human intelligence, and so that's just a comment on Mr. Snowden. But I'd like to go back to 9/11. The weather was perfect, and so forth. But nevertheless, when the PDB, President's Daily Briefing, goes to a president who happens to be on vacation, who may not have dealt with it as intelligently as he perhaps should have, and when you have agencies that do not cooperate with each other, which is still the case, I watch, and of course it's a show on TV, but I watch Madam Secretary, and you still, frankly, see agencies who will not cooperate with each other. Those folks that
that reported back to their, I don't know whether it was the FBI, I can't remember whether it was, wouldn't have been CIA, because they're not supposed to practice on the on our soil. But nevertheless, I don't know that the Zellico report, the 9/11 report, has that. Do you really feel like that has improved the cooperation among agencies so that this intelligence is shared, or are we overwhelmed in the amount of signal intelligence or human intelligence that we've collected and are not able to extrapolate, analyze, et cetera?
We're still overwhelmed, but their cooperation is a much more articulated and how shall I say, backed by legislation. The act that was passed in 2004 that reorganized the government so that you now have a director of national intelligence, but you also have a national counter-terrorist center, has added additional players to the game. And the notion of having a situation where a CIA officer, not a trained lawyer in most instances, but a collector, a spy overseas, has some knowledge of what the FBI does is very much part of that legislation, such that you now have case officers being assigned for a tour of duty in the Bureau and vice versa. The FBI had some excellent persons assigned to the United States at the time that we caught my spy school classmate, Ames, Aldrich Ames, after a long pursuit. So there's no question but what the Bureau and the CIA, just to name two, have to know exactly what pressures and what the description of their job is. The Bureau has to know that they don't have to make the arrest immediately. They ought to let the matter cook for a while. But the CIA guy has to know that sometime the arrest is going to have to happen, and they better make preparation and get the information up so it will be done. So more cooperation and more interrelationships between the professionals in a number of those agencies is very helpful.
Fred, in preparation for this, we talked about the qualifications that the CIA is seeking and how they do or do not bear on the needs of the job. Could you discuss that?
It just was my good fortune last weekend to catch up on my Economist magazines, and I happened on a full-page ad put out by the Central Intelligence Agency, the Directorate of Operations, setting forth their desire to have young Americans sign up for the business. And it set forth some of the qualifications that it wanted. Interestingly enough, but not surprising, and I would agree, they would like to have 3.5 years or thereabouts of foreign experience in business, having some commercial experience and living abroad. They want to have, obviously, a college degree. And blah, 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 blah. Down about 7th or 8th place was the competence in foreign languages. Now, those of you in this room will remember that former Secretary of State Jim Baker went with another fancy pants type to Iraq about 4 or 5 years ago to see how things were going. And he reported back to the Congress and to the President that in the green zone, thousands and thousands of American personnel, there were only 5 that could speak Arabic well enough to conduct a conversation with a television reporter. We've got to do better in that regard. But what I'm getting back to is in this advertisement for volunteers from CIA, the speaking the foreign languages was way down in the list of qualifications. I'm sorry, that won't cut it. We have got to get better at understanding the languages and the customs of a lot of places that just weren't on the map for us before.
I guess I just wonder, I haven't seen the advertisement, but I wonder the extent to which that reflects a belief that the way in which we conduct espionage is shifting to a more technological base. So in other words, yes, we do need people out there on the ground in foreign countries, but we more and more need people who can process and evaluate and analyze social media, look at connections among people, run computer programs that are engaged in sort of detecting patterns. And I think there is definitely a language element there for sure, but it's less spoken, maybe more read. You can read Arabic or so on. So I wonder if that reflects sort of a change in which, a change of the source of our intelligence given the threats.
No, I think that's a very good point. And I also think we almost have to have it as a given that we are scouring the normal sources, social media and the rest, because that's how the bad guys in the Middle East often are talking. But in order to have a longer term relationship, i.e. to get somebody early in the game who stays with it and reports back, in order to make that recruitment, certainly you're going to have number one, you're going to have access. You're not going to get it at an embassy cocktail party. But secondly, you're going to have to be able to understand what makes that person tick.
Okay, I have a question myself. It's been several minutes since we've talked about Snowden, so I think we got to get back to the basics here. If I heard it right, it sounds good that if he encountered something in his work that he thought was really bad, then he should have just come forward, and he could come out, and we could all sit around and talk about it and decide the merits or whatever. But the other side I've heard is that he just clearly black and white broke some criminal laws. The sanctions are very direct. They would have thrown him in the slammer and thrown away the key, and we'll sit around and discuss the philosophy of things, but he's basically a goner. And I'm not saying right or wrong or anything, but if that is a correct statement, then I think it's a little more complicated than if he felt he wanted to be able to get out the good word, he should just come forward and chat with all of us. What do you think?
I think it's a good point that you raised, but you see, if he is doing what he wanted to do was to make the world aware of what he considered to be an egregious practice by his own government. My point is, if he felt so strongly about that, why didn't he put it in a situation where I've done it and I'm willing to take the can for it, but I'm going to talk to the Congress, I'm going to talk to a court of law, I'm going to take whatever it is, and I'll explain what my views are on this. And it might not be as open and shut. That's a rather anodyne and perhaps even a sentimental plea on my part. My point is, if he felt so strongly that NSA was going over the line, he might have had more impact if he had engaged in a dialogue about it, whether it's in a court of law or his lawyer passing out the information, than the current situation where he's locked off in some I don't know, maybe it's a nice place in Russia, and acting as if he's committed a heroic act. I think he's probably lost as many friends as he gained by what he did. And if he really felt that on the merits we shouldn't be doing this, he would have had a better chance to set that forth after he was captured.
Could you talk a bit about what we're doing to thwart cyber warfare and how the court gets involved in that?
So I don't think the court does get involved in that. So one of the tricky questions when you talk about cyber warfare is what precisely that means. So one kind of cyber activity that we might actually think of as cyber warfare is the use of cyber tools during an ongoing armed conflict. And what the U.S. government has said about that is it believes that cyber tools in that context have to be used consistent with the laws of armed conflict. So there are complicated provisions about who you can target and how you take into account civilian harm and so on. And the government has said, we think the laws of war are suitable to regulate that. Then there's another category of question, which is, when does a cyber attack, when is it so significant, and when does it produce so much harm that we might actually treat it like an armed attack under the UN Charter that triggers our right of self-defense? And the government has said, if cyber produced a result that involved kinetic harm, damaged buildings, killed people, we would treat that like an armed attack. We would apply the standard international law that regulates resort to force, and we would reserve the right to respond in self-defense. And we would reserve the right to use self-defense in a kinetic way, not just in the cyber, not just having to respond in cyber. The place in the real world where that's come the closest is the Stuxnet virus. I don't know if you are all familiar with that, but there was the U.S. and Israel reportedly engaged in a cyber attack against centrifuges within an Iranian nuclear facility, and it actually destroyed 1,000 of the centrifuges. So that's the closest we've seen in an interstate context of producing tangible damage of that kind. So, and then there are other complicated questions about cyber espionage, commercial cyber espionage, which we are upset at the level of espionage by the Chinese, and we've concluded the U.S. and China basically have agreed not to engage in commercial cyber espionage, that is, stealing intellectual property of U.S. companies and then taking it back to China and giving it to Chinese companies so they can help manufacture things more quickly. And the Chinese and we have agreed to not engage in that activity where it's intended to benefit a domestic company. So cyber is a very complicated area, but it is not actually an area where the FISA court is playing a role.
And I would think, just to add to that, I think that's a very good dissection of the problem, but I would suspect that the National Security Agency is involved in this in a major way. That's been the outfit that's really had to expand the most, because Stuxnet, as you point out, was an example, but there are others that have been on the cusp of taking place and others that have taken place that we haven't, the country that was victimized hasn't told us about.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is, I don't think Snowden couldn't have made a bigger impact than the way he did it. Just so that, for you to say he could have made a bigger impact by doing it the other way, I really don't think so. My question is, you mentioned foreign nationals versus American citizens. What about people with dual citizenship?
I assume that they're treated like American citizens. In the statutory analysis, if they hold American citizenship, they would be treated as American citizens, even if they also happen to hold Canadian citizenship or Swiss nationality, too.
In terms of the metadata, and instead of NSA storing all the information about whether it's telephonic communications or emails or whatever it may be, you think it's a good trade-off to say that you're going to leave it up to the Verizons of the world to keep the data instead of NSA? What if they decide they don't want to do it? A lot of them, and many during those discussions about that, they said they didn't really want to keep the data. Whether people are aware of it or not, the telephone communications people for at least, I can go back to the 60s at least, probably before that, just like all the cables were red during the war, cable traffic, there was informal, whether it was legal or not, there was informal agreements, and there was all kinds of information being passed to the whatever security agency at the time was collecting that data. And I'm not sure what a good trade-off it is to have the, what's your opinion on that? Have the ISPs keep the data, and the government can only ask for it if they feel they need some specific information.
Just
to fill in some of the detail with respect to the operation that you were talking about, Operation Venona, which was something that was undertaken by the FBI for the most part, but involved other intelligence agencies, NSA and the rest, got going in the very early stages of the war and continued well into the Cold War because we were trying to make book on what the plans of the of Stalin and the Russians were. Remember when he went into the one-year tank of no war with Germany? We wondered when it was going to come out. Well, what happened was the Bureau was collecting at Western Union Telegraph in New York City and in Washington, D.C., every cable that the Soviets, Soviet missions were sending back, the consulate and the embassy, during that period of time, setting forth what they were up to. So the answer is, I think, probably as has been mentioned here several times, because of the electronic nature of it, the volume that you're talking about is humongous. And so, and the ways we use to sort of track it, index it, get at what is going on, have to be equally good. But how you draw a line and say we'll take this and we won't take that, I would think would be fairly difficult. Sorry.
So my understanding is that the phone companies and ISPs tend to hold this data for about 18 months naturally. And it was the case, I think, at some point that the U.S. government was worried about that not being long enough, especially its interest in sort of tracking back historical trends. But I don't think the USA Freedom Act contains a provision requiring that it hold that data for longer. And what that tells me is that the executive ultimately concluded that it could live with having 18 months worth of data to access, because after all, the president signed the USA Freedom Act, didn't veto it, so the intelligence community must have gotten comfortable with that, because after all, more recent data tends to be more relevant than older data.
This does not apply to me, hopefully not ever, but regarding the TSA no-fly list, can you address any parallels or contrast with the secrecy in FISA procedures and the secrecy regarding people getting off the no-fly list?
There have been some lawsuits. I don't know precisely how that works, but you're absolutely right. That would be, for many people, a terrible burden to bear, and they had to... You would want to have rights that allowed, under the proper circumstances, for the individual to be confronted with the information that keeps him or her from being permitted to fly. Just assuming that any airline obviously is going to bend over backwards to make sure they're protected against an event.
I'm sorry, I don't have expertise in the area, so I don't know the answer.
The New York Times this morning had an article about how well we're knocking off the cash flow of ISIS, but how difficult it is to access all of the small cells. Do we still need to do more? Should we have known about the incident? It was Los Angeles, California, several months back.
You mean San Bernardino?
San Bernardino, yeah. I don't do, you know, that New Yorker magazine. I'm a New Yorker, and there's nothing between here and the West Coast, wherever it was. But the problem of finding these small groups, do we need to do more? I'm very conflicted about this, because right after 9/11, I was traveling with an American citizen who was a Sikh. He didn't wear a turban, but he was pulled out, and I had to go to my conference alone. And that was profiling, and it was upsetting. On the other hand, San Bernardino is pretty upsetting, too. Do we need to do more? Has the dial moved again?
Actually, I'll let you be the law school representative on this.
I'm not speaking on behalf of the
CIA guy.
I'm speaking, of course, in my personal capacity and not on behalf of anybody. But so I heard Lisa Monaco talk recently. She's the president's homeland security advisor. She gave a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations, and you know, she basically indicated that this is the hardest problem that they're wrestling with, that it is so difficult to detect an individual who decides on his or her own with very little outside instruction, and let's assume that there was an outside instruction, that it was maybe they were motivated by things they read on the internet, but it was really just a man and his wife deciding to do something. It's very, very hard to figure out how to address that, stop it from happening, other than steps that go way back to try to make people feel as though they're not disenfranchised and so on. But I think that is the kind of thing that keeps our national security apparatus up at night, particularly now that we're seeing these smaller scale attacks happen in Europe. I think there's just a real concern that we will see more like that.
I think that's well put, and I also think that if you had any of, just judging from the accounts that described how they behaved from their arrival in the United States and how they would show up at different events in San Bernardino, and it looked like they were not happy campers, and I think you've got to figure that out. You have to bend over backwards to make sure that that's not going to lead to a disaster, as hard as that may be.
Thank you very much for clarifying many of the finer points of the FISA experience. I was just curious if, given the 2020 hindsight that you now have from what has happened since, let's say, 9/11, are there any points at which you think we could have done things in a way that would have been less critical? By that I mean more consistent with some of the provisions of our Constitution or our understanding of our form of government, which is, after all, less than a perfect union. But we try. And I'd ask Fred to share in that.
Sorry, Ashley, I didn't mean to grab the mic, but I think the notion, and you know, there was, I'm not trying to cast asparagus on him, but the notion that we had not had a hijacking turn into a suicide mission prior to this was something that ought to have been examined more carefully. Usually, as you remember, Bert, they'd capture the aircraft, go maybe over to Cuba for a swim, but eventually they wanted to come back to the United States, and that's why the pilots never rose up in rebellion, because they knew they'd have to fly them back. But it seemed to me they were living in a fool's paradise, and some of the pilots kind of said that. Why in the world hadn't we locked that door to the cockpit long before? But it seemed to me that was just a horrible way to learn the lesson, but we learned it.
So I guess three things come to mind. I'm an international lawyer by training, and I spent 10 years in the State Department where I did primarily international law. So my first answer has to do with international law, which is not a constitutional question per se, but I think one of the biggest mistakes that the Bush administration made in the wake of 9/11 dealt with the way in which they approached the treatment of members of al-Qaeda and the Taliban who they captured. And the idea there was that there were things they could have done. They could have said, for example, Common Article 3, which is a basic provision requiring humane treatment, applied as a matter of law. They could have said, we're going to treat these individuals, we're going to give them a number of protections found in the Geneva Conventions, even if you don't strictly call them prisoners of war. I think there were a lot of things in that area that that we could have done better. Our military was trained that way, and we're told after they got underway, starting to treat people these ways, stop, we're doing it a different way. I think that was a big problem that led to many, many problems with allies. The second thing I would say is there was a lot of reliance on the president's Article II power. So, for example, there was something called the Terrorist Surveillance Program that I didn't mention here, but this was a immediate post 9/11 decided to start conducting electronic surveillance of individuals who were calling into the country, or that one end was in the United States. And there was, the FISA was in existence, and the administration said, well, we don't have to follow FISA because we're relying on the president's Article II powers under the authorization for the use of military force. It was a difficult legal argument, not very persuasive. And so I think that sort of excessive willingness to resort to the executive going it alone was not ideal. The third thing I would say is, you know, I just listened to this really interesting program on Radiolab called 60 Words, and they spent an hour talking about 60 words, and those 60 words are the authorization for the use of military force that Congress enacted on September 14th, 2001. And all of the, they call it a Christmas tree, so all of the justifications for what we've done on lots of levels, detention, targeting ISIS, and so on, have all been spawned from those 60 words. There's a good argument that Congress should have stepped up and issued a new authorization with regard, for example, to ISIS. So Congress has been pretty absent here. So in the dream world that you envisioned, Congress would be, you know, updating the authorization for the use of military force and so on. We don't, however, live in that dream world, so I don't expect Congress to be doing that.
The subject of encryption has been passing by on the fly in this, and of course that involves communications, and communications is largely what the FISA court business is about. So the question of encryption involved here has come up recently in the Apple versus FBI controversy, and it became clear that Apple didn't want to compromise the security of their phones. I read at one point that their engineers inside the company threatened to rebel if the management caved in. But I also noticed comments by General Hayden, who had been head of the NSA, and I believe he was also head of CIA. Yes, so he was actually the head of both agencies at different times. So he's very qualified to speak on this question. And General Hayden expressed the opinion that our country was better off with unbreakable encryption for everything. I'm paraphrasing what he said, but that's how I interpreted it. The implications of that are that that getting messages, which the FISA court is often allowing the security agencies to do, doesn't mean you're going to get much more than the metadata. If encryption really comes to pass universally, it's not just inside the iPhone, it's all the communications that the NSA intercepts. So they no longer have content to look at. They still have metadata, and metadata is very valuable. In the San Bernardino case, there was a report that the FBI had the metadata on who the San Bernardino people had been talking to.
It's a good point. On the issue of names, as I said, for the Joe Doakes reader of NSA reports, they don't get the names. They might get a reference to two Americans or something of that kind, but they don't get the names. So they've been scrupulous on that for quite a period of time. But your question goes a little bit further, and it seems to me that we've got to be sensible, subject to a change of law that might bring this about, that in certain instances, time won't permit too much dancing around. We've got to be willing to go forward and bet the farm that with this something that you've uncovered on these two that in San Bernardino ought to be looked at by something other than a local postmaster.
One more question.
Can I say something on that?
Yes.
So the encryption issue is very interesting to me, in part because I spent a lot of time in what's called the interagency process, and that means fighting with other government agencies about how to achieve the outcome you're all trying to achieve. And the encryption debate has surfaced some significant interagency disputes, even intra-agency disputes about the right way to go in on encryption. And James Comey, who's the director of the FBI, has reportedly said that encryption is the hardest issue he's ever worked on while he's been in government. So it's a very difficult question. But one interesting thing I wanted to add is that we are not the only country that's interested in the outcome of the encryption debate. And there are other countries out there that are potentially going to insist that the manufacturers be able to unlock phones or produce unencrypted data for their law enforcement and intelligence services. So even if we come down saying there should be total encryption, if we take the General Hayden approach that we are better off if there's robust encryption, it's quite likely that there will be other countries that don't take that view and say to Apple, you cannot sell that product in our country unless you provide us with some access. So while it is a robust debate here, I think it is, you can't disassociate it from debates that are going to happen in other countries, especially countries like China where there are a lot of customers.
One final question.
More
well, please join me in thanking Ashley and Fred.